You're listening to another.
Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler, March 27th, 2015. Spring is supposed to be in the air, but here in New York, maybe not so much. I hope you've all had a terrific week. I thank you for joining me at the end of the week to play the, I guess we could call it the inevitable game of catch-up. Lots to talk about, lots of madness in particular, especially from Washington, D.C., but from around the country as well. Those of you familiar with me know I'm a retired senior special agent with the former INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service. And the focus of my program is generally immigration and related areas of national security, and today will be no different. I've written a bunch of articles for different publications, and I want to discuss what I've been coming up with, what I've been running into, because well, I think we have a problem with the phone. I'm going to be right back on the air. Sorry. Here we go. I think we're back on the air. Bear with me, folks. We have a little technical problem. I'll be right back with you. There we go. Sorry about the technical difficulties, such as the era, or maybe error, that we live in these days. Again, this is Mike Cutler. This is the Michael Cutler Hour. And I've been writing articles for a number of websites, so let me put my own personal website out there first. It's michaelcutler.net, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. I also have been a senior fellow with a terrific organization, based in Santa Barbara, California. Beautiful place to be, great people. Californians for Population Stabilization. Their terrific website is capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. I write for Front Page Magazine, sponsored by the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I have articles posted on the Social Contract, and this quarter is no different, where I talked about human capital, the most valuable of all of America's resources. I've also been working with the folks at Progressives for Immigration Reform. If you want to find them easily, just punch in PFIR, Progressives for Immigration Reform. And as their name implies, they are on the left side of the issue. They come at things from a far more liberal perspective. But immigration isn't about left or right. It's about right or wrong. Barbara Jordan, who had been a very liberal member of Congress, congresswoman from Texas, unfortunately she passed away, but her commission, the Jordan Commission, made it clear that immigration was critical. Her position parallels that which I have heard from the staunchest supposed conservatives and then some, because this is about protecting American lives and the jobs of American workers, about ensuring the survival of our country and our citizens, and providing opportunities for our children and for their children. This isn't about left or right. Everybody has those aspirations for their kids. We may come at it from different perspectives. We may disagree about certain issues, but on the need for secure borders, and not just the Mexican border, that charade has got to stop, but the entire immigration system needs to have integrity. It's about keeping out the criminals, keeping out the terrorists, and keeping those people out of the country who would compete unfairly with American workers and thereby drive down wages and displace Americans, and in the process send ever more amounts of money out of our economy through the remittances, the money wired out of our country to their home countries. So as I keep saying, this isn't about left or right. It's about right or wrong. I want to start out. I just wrote an article. We'll start with the most recent first, I guess. And most recently, the folks at Front Page Magazine published my article, and it's about, incredibly as it may sound to you, that right now we have police departments around the country hiring, believe it or not, non-citizen police officers. I just want you to stop and let that soak in. I want you to think about it. And so the way that they entitled it on the front page website that's on today's edition is illegal alien police officers with a question mark. And, you know, the lunacy that we're hearing from police departments around the country is we want to be inclusive. We know we have ever more immigrants in the United States. So wouldn't it be nice if we can have police officers who match the population that we have living here in our country? And this is so wrongheaded on so many ways, I don't even know where to begin to discuss this. But, you know, I originally got an email from a friend of mine who does a radio show out in Arizona, and this was last week. And initially, I thought, gee whiz, Charles Heller, who has his program in Arizona, this has to be a spoof. And I checked the calendar to make sure it wasn't April Fool's Day, April 1st. You know, citizenship is a very important issue. It's the way that we bestow equal treatment to foreign nationals who come to America so they can truly be full participants in our society. Citizenship is the highest honor we can bestow upon an alien, because once we bestow citizenship upon them, they're no longer aliens. And other than the positions of president and vice president, we've had naturalized citizens serve in every other position in our government. Mayors and governors and members of the presidential cabinet, members of the Senate, members of the House of Representatives. Once you become a naturalized American citizen, you become one of us. What could be fairer than to expect that a person who is charged with protecting a community has a badge, a weapon, a police car, access to police databases, should be a citizen of the United States? As it is, we know that the process by which we naturalize aliens, give them citizenship, is flawed. We have seen numerous examples of people who were naturalized who went on to commit acts of terrorism. Most recently, the FBI, and I wrote about this for Progressives for Immigration Reform, if I can get the words out, put a naturalized Somali citizen, he's now an American, on the most wanted list of terrorists. He had been driving a taxi cab in Washington, D.C. for years, and right on the poster that the FBI published, they said, "We are concerned because this guy, as a cab driver, has an intimate knowledge of America's capital. And the concern is that he's right now fighting, they believe, in the Middle East, that if he comes back, he would be in the position to launch a terrorist operation against Washington, D.C., or he might train people, because cab drivers know the back roads, they know the ins, the outs, the infrastructure of the cities in which they drive. Nobody probably knows the streets better than a cab driver. So here's a guy who was a cab driver for a bunch of years. He's now fighting on the side of ISIS. The concern is he's going to come back and launch an attack. So the FBI has issued a substantial reward, and they're saying, help us find him. Let us know if you know that he's back here." This is how serious citizenship is. Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber, was a naturalized United States citizen. Of course, being delusional, the New York City police commissioner at the time, Ray Kelly, described Faisal Shahzad as a classic example of a homegrown terrorist. In point of fact, he came here as a 20-year-old on a student visa, subsequently acquired citizenship, and a year after getting citizenship, tried to set off a car bomb, in an SUV that he parked at Times Square, the crossroads of the world, probably one of the heaviest pedestrian trafficked areas in the entire United States of America. And immediately, the police commissioner for what is arguably the most sophisticated police department in the world, the NYPD, comes out and says, "Oh, this guy's a classic example of homegrown." No, he's not homegrown. He came here when he was 20 years old, but we did give him citizenship. And there have been other terrorists who have been naturalized. One of the two Tsarnaev brothers, in fact, the Boston Marathon bombers, was a naturalized citizen. So I think we need to look at the way we naturalize aliens and the way that we screen them. You know, if you go back historically, if you go back to my background as an immigration agent, they used to, they being us, immigration agents would go out and do investigations to determine whether or not an alien should be naturalized, because one of the requirements was good moral character. Pardon me. And good moral character is more than no felony arrests. An individual who owes child support for his children and fails to pay them is not of good moral character. A guy who frequents brothels and houses of prostitution and does other activities, goes to illegal gambling houses, that would all figure into what was called a GMC, good moral character investigation. To my knowledge, they don't even conduct good moral character investigations. They can't crank the applications through the process fast enough. They can't move them more quickly than they could possibly want. Citizenship and Immigration Services right now processes over 6 million applications a year. They only have a staff of several thousand people to move millions of applications. And the reality is that if you deny an application, it may take you days or weeks to do it all. If you approve most applications, it could be done in minutes or certainly under an hour. And if your goal, as we keep hearing, is to clear up the backlog, the easiest way to clear up the backlog is just to approve everything. Just approve everything. So now we have a situation where people are getting employment authorization, and there are actually municipalities around the country that have made it clear. We don't even care if the alien has a green card or not. As long as they have employment authorization, we're willing to give them a badge and a firearm. And that stops me dead in my tracks. You look at the DACA program, Deferred Action Childhood Arrival Program. The approval rate is in excess of 97%, from what I have heard from one of the members of Congress who sits on the Homeland Security Committee. I mean, what kind of scrutiny are we talking about if 97% of the applications are approved? There is no face-to-face interview. There are no field investigations being conducted. And if you believe, as the mayor of a town, that it is appropriate to give somebody who's been granted employment authorization, doesn't even have a green card, to give that person a badge and a gun, this is a problem. It's a huge problem. The other issues also that come into play, besides the fact that obviously if the screening process is flawed and it's very easy to acquire false names, because, again, no field investigation, no face-to-face interview, you're dealing with people who ran the border. Certainly you would have to call the question whether someone like that could even be or should even be naturalized if you enter the United States by running the border and then perhaps engaging in identity theft and using false identities. And so we had a case where an aspiring model was just killed by one of these so-called dreamers, these deferred action cases. The government goes out, they did another article for CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization, you know, in the front door, out the back door, 30,000 plus criminal aliens released by ICE in 2014. And they round up a bunch of aliens after they've released them. They called it Operation Cross-Check. Boy, it sounds tough. Operation Cross-Check, you know, it inspires confidence. And they arrested over 2,000 criminal aliens in a four-day period around the country from 94 different countries. Again, it's not about Mexico or Latin America, 94 countries. It's Europe and Asia and you name it. It turned out that 15 of the people that were captured had been involved with DACA applications. One had been denied the application. If I remember correctly, all of the others were granted temporary employment authorization. And they were arrested. One of them caught with a gun. I don't believe he was a police officer, though. So what I'd like to know from those mayors is, are you willing to give one of these DACA cases a badge and a firearm and police authority? Because if that's what we're doing, we are setting up our country and our fellow Americans in towns around America for a disaster. Imagine what it would mean for a terrorist or a member of a drug cartel to get one or more of their players into those trusted positions as police officers. This is a very dangerous kind of a situation. And one of the police officials or mayors had boasted, well, you know, if the person served honorably in the military at least for a year and got an honorable discharge, that's good enough for us. Well, not so fast. The FBI has released a series of reports about gang activity in the military, where gang graffiti has been showing up in the Middle East. And the reason that gang graffiti has been showing up in the Middle East is because we have welcomed in to our military illegal aliens, offered them, you know, lawful status. And we have to be very careful and very clear about something. There have been quite a few aliens who've entered the military, even as illegal aliens, who've made amazing sacrifices. Some have made the ultimate sacrifice, paid with their lives. And I want to be certain that we understand exactly what I'm saying. It's not that anybody who's not a citizen who served in the military is our enemy. Some of them may well be valiant. The question here is may well be. We don't know what everyone else is there for. And so the idea of giving firearms, tactical training, and so forth to people who shouldn't be in the United States is, again, a dangerous practice. And we had the Enlist Act that was proposed by a congressman in California, and he said, oh, we'll take all these young men who are here illegally, young women who are here illegally, put them in the military, and a year later give them citizenship. Why on earth do you want to take illegal aliens who entered our country without inspection, came in under the radar, and say, okay, you can join the military? We had the Fort Hood shooting. We have the problem with gangs in the military, problems with giving training to people who might ultimately do harm to us. I think it is only reasonable that a person who is admitted into the military at least have a green card. And when we talk about patrolling our streets of our towns and cities, that should be a job for American citizens. It really should. First of all, these are good careers. And even if it's a small town police department where the salary isn't great and the conditions aren't the best, it's a great stepping stone. And if you take a young man or woman who serves in a police department that way for several years, has a college education, they could certainly seek to become a federal agent. They could seek to move on to major police departments around the country. This is a good career opportunity. You know, I spent 30 years as a federal agent. I'm very proud of having been a federal agent, as are my colleagues, although we're extremely disappointed with what the federal government has turned into on the immigration issue, on so many other issues. But this notion that we're going to take people who simply got permission to work and say, yep, here's a gun, here's a badge, here's a uniform, go out there. These are folks who may not understand the culture of America, the concept of democracy, freedom of speech. You know, it's a startling difference for so many people to come to the United States, perhaps coming from countries where freedom of speech is a dream, to not understand how to deal with people who protest, people who may take a different viewpoint, people who may use foul language, whatever. You know, when you're in law enforcement, you see the good, the bad, and the ugly, and you need people with cool heads and an understanding and an appreciation and perhaps an affection, not infection, but affection for our fellow Americans. One of the things I'm always disturbed by is that if you look at most radio and television programs, they are either liberal or conservative programs. We have intellectual inbreeding. You almost never see a liberal guest on a conservative show or vice versa. And I think it's important that we have diversity in our viewpoints. You know, I'm a lifelong registered Democrat. Very often I'm on conservative programs. But the more liberal shows don't want Mike Cutler on because that's not a liberal viewpoint. It's amazing what is considered appropriate, inappropriate, what's liberal, what's not liberal. Protecting America is not a liberal or a conservative concept, but you would never know it to listen to the talking heads. So my concern is that by putting foreign nationals into our police departments, giving them unfettered access to our cities, to firearms, could come back to haunt us, come back to bite us. If terrorists want to gain access to a country, where better should they put their people than into an official position that gives them free access? Look what just 19 terrorists did, not just to New York, not just to the United States, but to the whole world on September 11th, 2001. We are continually told, or at least we had been, we don't hear it quite so frequently now, but boy, oh boy, for years after 9/11, the terrorists got to get it right only once, and we've got to be right 100% of the time. 19 terrorists killed 3,000, actually more than 3,000 when you realize how many people have subsequently passed away, how many people are still sick. The economic impact was huge. And what have we done in response? Made it that much easier for foreign nationals to enter our country. We hear this nonsense. I was just watching Neil Cavuto today speaking with the governor of Texas. We've got to secure that border. We've got to secure that border. We've got, that's all we keep hearing about. We're hearing it from Ted Cruz. It becomes a debate point for the Democrats, and the Republicans say, first, we're going to secure the border. I was on my friend Ann Ubelis's blog talk radio program earlier today. Her co-host said to me, Mike, what do you think about securing the border first? I said, first, what second? Giving millions of people who snuck into the country identity documents without an interview? So I want to read, and I've read in the past, segments of the 9/11 Commission report, the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. But see, this whole notion about let's secure the Mexican border first because it sounds macho is foolish. Now, I don't want anyone getting it wrong. I'm not telling you we should not secure the border. Of course we should. Of course we should. But securing the U.S.-Mexican border is only one of many steps that needs to be taken, which is why I wrote a commentary, Front Page Magazine, and I called it Border Security in the Immigration Colander. Securing the Mexican border is kind of like plugging one of the holes in the bottom of the colander and then declaring that you can now use that colander, that bowl with all the holes in it that we use to drain pasta, that this is now suitable as a bucket. And not just to carry water, but deadly fluids that if they leaked out might kill people. Remember, one of the things the 9/11 Commission had made the point was that in order to attack us, the terrorists had to come here first. That was the first. Part two for them was to embed themselves, hide in plain sight. And in both cases, how do they do it? Violate the immigration laws, violate our borders. But listen to what they had to say. And this is on page 54 of the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. During the 1990s, Al-Qaeda was either directly or indirectly involved in a number of terrorist plots in the United States that partially or totally failed. A study of these plots and how those involved in them moved about clearly indicates that foreign terrorist operatives were being planted in the United States, and that foreign terrorist operations were being planned against Americans here at home. The attempted operations were valuable to those carrying them out, despite their lack of success, because they gave Islamic terrorists critical operational experience in entering and embedding in the United States. Although there is evidence that some land and sea border entries without inspection occurred, these conspirators mainly subverted the legal entry system, by entering at airports. When was the last time you heard a Republican or a Democrat say, first, let's make sure that illegal aliens don't gain access to the United States by any means possible? Have you heard that statement from anybody? No. What you're hearing is, first, we'll secure the Mexican border. So does that mean that it's okay if you stow away on a ship? Does that mean it's okay if you run the Canadian border? Does that mean it's wonderful if you come under the visa waiver program, which we keep expanding when they should stop the visa waiver program altogether, 38 countries now on that list? So it's okay if you come by visa waiver program and fail to leave and get lost? Is that okay? Is it okay if you come with a student visa? Or if you commit fraud by marrying an American but don't really live with them? What is this business about first secure the border? If you don't prevent illegal aliens from entering the United States, and inevitably there will be those who get by you, then you need a plan B. A baseball team has a plan B for the batter standing at the plate by putting outfielders in the outfield. Why are the outfielders out there? They are out there in case the guy with the bat is powerful enough to hit the ball over the infielder's heads. This is the equivalent of looking at it and saying, well, what if the guy gets admitted and disappears? What if the guy does get past the Border Patrol? What's your plan B? In baseball, plan B is the outfield. You have a left fielder, a center fielder, and a guy who covers right field. Why? They're there to shag the balls that make their way over the heads of the infield. If you take the outfielders out of the game, any batter who could hit the ball over the infielder's heads gets an in-the-park home run, period. You can't possibly win the game unless you have people in the outfield who are competent at catching the balls that fly over the heads of the infield. You can't possibly protect America unless you have agents doing interior enforcement to go after the aliens who either enter through ports of entry under the lawful process or get into the country by running the northern border, running the southern border, stowing away on ships. We are a country of 50 border states. But again, you don't hear that. So now they make this point about how these conspirators mainly subverted the legal entry system by entering at airports. Now, look how they follow up. And this goes to my point about the outfielders. In so doing, that is to say these terrorists, they relied on a wide variety of fraudulent documents, on aliases, and on government corruption. Because terrorist operations were not suicide missions in the early to mid-1990s, once in the United States, terrorists and their supporters tried to get legal immigration status that would permit them to remain here, primarily by committing serial or repeated immigration fraud, by claiming political asylum, and by marrying Americans. Many of these tactics would remain largely unchanged and undetected throughout the 1990s and up to the 9/11 attack. So they're talking about trying to get lawful status so they can work here. So if you had such a terrorist who understands the playbook and says, okay, I'm going to go in under DACA and I'm going to get permission to work, where does that leave us? Put this guy in a police department? They go on and say this. Thus, abuse of the immigration system and a lack of interior immigration enforcement were unwittingly working together to support terrorist activity. It will remain largely unknown since no agency of the United States government analyzed terrorist travel patterns until after 9/11. This lack of attention meant that critical opportunities to disrupt terrorist travel and therefore deadly terrorist operations were missed. And then we get to page 98, and I've read this so many times before, but I'm compelled to read it again, because this is what you're not hearing from any of the candidates or from the news media. Everyone is ignoring this. Terrorists in the 1990s, as well as the September 11th hijackers, needed to find a way to stay in or embed themselves in the United States if their operational plans were to come to fruition. As already discussed, this could be accomplished legally by marrying an American citizen, achieving temporary worker status, here we go again, or applying for asylum after entering. In many cases, the act of filing for an immigration benefit sufficed to permit the alien to remain in the country until the petition was adjudicated. Terrorists were free to conduct surveillance, coordinate operations, obtain and receive funding, go to school and learn English, make contacts in the United States, acquire necessary materials, and execute an attack. So it is so crystal clear in the words of the 9/11 Commission staff report that this isn't about the Mexican border. Should we secure that border? Absolutely. I don't want someone saying, hey, this guy Cutler said we don't have to worry about the Mexican border. That would be crazy. But it's no less crazy than saying that's all that we should do. I compare the Mexican border and security on that border to the wing of an airplane. Without a wing, the airplane doesn't fly. But if all you have is a wing, it just sits there and goes nowhere, because that airplane needs a fuselage and landing gear and tail and engine, avionics, control surfaces, right? How many components are there in an airplane? So if all we're talking about is a wing, the Mexican border, how do you fly a wing by itself? And don't tell me flying wing if there's some wise guy out there, because even the flying wing is a misnomer, because the fuselage and everything else is incorporated within the wing, if you think about the B-2 bomber. So the point that I'm making, all joking aside, because this is not a joking matter, is that we are being sold a three-legged racehorse and expecting it to win, and it won't win. We're telling a baseball team that you can tell the outfielders to stay in the dugout and watch TV. We don't need them, but we'll win the game anyway. Doesn't work that way, folks. Immigration is a complex system. And people say, well, if we had mandatory E-Verify, then that would solve the problem. No, it wouldn't. Now, does that mean that I don't think we should have mandatory E-Verify? No, quite the contrary. We need to have mandatory E-Verify. But again, if you're giving people employment authorization and there's no integrity to that process, you're going to give that magic card, the key to the front door, the people who should not have it. The people who should not have it. Think of the keys that you've seen in your offices that say do not duplicate. Why do they say that? Because they don't want some unauthorized person to get a copy of the key. When you go to hotels, they use electronic keys altogether now because they can control what rooms you can open so that you don't open all the doors. And the staff members who do have access to all the doors, whenever they open a door, it generally registers in the computer so that they have a record of who came in at what time and how long they stayed and so forth to prevent theft and so forth. So simply saying, well, we'll have you verify. No, it's not enough. The key is to make certain that people who get authorization to work, people who get green cards, who get status in the country, are entitled. And so it was interesting, the way the title for my article for Front Page Magazine was written, I gave them a slightly different title. Any of you who are familiar with the writing process know that you work with an editor and sometimes the editor changes the title. I think my editor did the right thing. Because, you know, this idea about, you know, illegal alien police officers, question mark, we don't know. Simply because, and this is the kind of chaos created by the president's executive orders. He does not, even as president, have the authority to convey lawful status on illegal aliens. That's what's so remarkable about all of this. This is a country of law. He is not a dictator. He is not a king. He's not a potentate. He can't take out his magic pen and put a little check mark on your back and say, congratulations, I hereby legalize you. You know, I've hereby knighted you with my pen. It doesn't work that way. The law is very specific about what conditions must be met for an alien to be eligible to get lawful status, for an alien to acquire U.S. citizenship. And so the president used the so-called prosecutorial discretion, claiming that we didn't have the resources, so it makes sense to focus limited resources on the more serious threats. So let me just tell you quickly about my take on this also, folks, because this is very important. 2 days after the president went to the Rose Garden, this was a few years ago, and he talked about prosecutorial discretion and about the dreamers. And by the way, isn't it remarkable that the A in dreamers is alien, but if you use the word alien, normally you'll get attacked by the folks who are pro-open borders anarchists. And he says, well, this is about prosecutorial discretion. And it's a lie. I don't know any polite way of saying this, because when I'm being lied to, I get very worked up. I don't like being lied to. I don't want to be lied to by my family members, and I don't want to be lied to by my leaders, especially the President of the United States. This is about a lack of integrity, and it comes from both political parties. We're being lied to and bamboozled every time we turn around and listen to those people. There's a handful of members of Congress who are trustworthy, and the rest of them, my goodness gracious, you know, they need nose jobs. Their noses are growing. They're part of what I call the Pinocchio Club. Prosecutorial discretion means that the fish is too small. I'm going to throw it back. I'm going to take no action. I don't have time to be bothered. A good example of prosecutorial discretion, and we've all been there. You're driving down the highway. The sun is shining. Traffic is light. Everything is wonderful. You're listening to your favorite music. And you zip through a radar trap, and all of a sudden you see the cop standing there with that radar gun. And you look down at your speedometer, and you're 8 miles an hour over the speed limit. You're 9 miles, 10 miles, whatever. And you get that metallic taste in your throat, and you're thinking, oh, darn, I'm going to get myself a ticket, just what I needed. And lo and behold, the cop doesn't budge. He stays there. You keep on going. And, you know, your heart's pounding away, and you think, boy, that was close. Don't need the ticket, don't need the fine, don't want this to hurt my insurance. By the way, that's what deterrence is about. You're concerned that if you do something illegal, there will be significant adverse consequences. It's funny that Pelosi called this sort of thing when it deals with illegal aliens a climate of fear. A climate of fear is what's known as deterrence. If you're not in violation of law, you have nothing to fear. But the fact that you were speeding when you went through the trap, yeah, you violated the law. Now you're worried about the consequences. And lo and behold, what a glorious day, the cop doesn't come after you. Why doesn't he come after you? Well, you weren't doing anything dangerous. You know, you didn't have wobbly wheels. The car wasn't held together with rubber bands. And he says, well, the car looks like it's in good shape. The road is empty and dry. The person's not endangering anyone, and I know if I wait another 5 minutes, someone doing 80 is bound to come flying down here and that's the person I want to stop. That is a legitimate example of prosecutorial discretion. Limited resources being marshaled to get the most bang for the buck. If he stops that person going 8 miles over the limit, that's when the guy going 80 or 90 is going to go flying by. So what do? You allow the minor infraction to go by while you wait for the juicier, more significant one. Absolutely, that is appropriate prosecutorial discretion. And when I worked with Senator Al D'Amato to create the aggravated felon reentry law to make reentry for criminal aliens a 20-year crime, separate and distinct from non-criminal aliens where the maximum was 2 years in jail, one of the other things we talked about was to prioritize enforcement. But here's the difference. What I had suggested and what my colleagues who went to see D'Amato off the record suggested to the senator at the time, at the time he was the New York State senior senator, the position now held by Chuck Schumer. And we've got to stop showing all this deference, Mr. Senator, call them by their first name. They work for us. Let's remind them who's the tail and who's the dog. You know, for far too long, the tail's been wagging the dog. This has to stop. This has to stop. I'm not asking you to be disrespectful or even suggesting it. But goodness gracious, you know, we bend over backwards and we treat these folks with such deference, and they're treating us as though we were garbage. It's got to stop. It's got to stop. Make it clear. You work for me. Your name is Chuck. Your name is Bill. Your name is Susan. That's who you are. You know, we've got to remind them who's who and what's what and what the pecking order really is. Go back to the Constitution. Citizen is the highest position in our government. But I've distracted myself. So to get back to the point at hand. So when they talk about discretion, what they're doing now is taking resources that we don't have, not to ignore them, but to process them. When I said to Senator D'Amato, look, you don't want to allow people who are here illegally think that no matter what, they've got nothing to worry about if they have no criminal history. What we really need to do is to focus on people who were convicted of crimes, people that we have warrants for, people that we have solid intelligence on. However, and this is a very big and important however, folks, what I also told the senator is that when you do encounter an illegal alien because you're looking for someone, you know, you have a warrant for Joe Smith, and you find Bob Jones, and Bob Jones is an illegal alien from Canada or Great Britain, and you say to the guy, who are you? And he says, well, I'm Bob Jones. Well, where did you come from? Oh, I came here from Canada. How long ago? 8 months ago. Well, you're only allowed 6 months. Are you working? Well, not really. Maybe a little bit. Do you have a Social Security card? What have you got? And you realize, hey, you got this guy who's an illegal alien. You bring the person in, and you hold them for deportation. Very small fish, but you're doing it for a reason. This wasn't the primary focus of your operation that day, but this way, if that guy who's simply, quote-unquote, simply an illegal alien, and you put the person up for a deportation hearing, the word on the street is very simple. Anybody who violates the borders, anybody who violates our immigration laws on the wrong day can be encountered by an immigration enforcement officer and pay the price, be deported. That way, you maintain the integrity of the system and respect for the law. To simply say, oh, you don't have any criminal convictions, we don't care. What message are you telling people? Yeah, we spend $3.3 billion a year inspecting passengers and cargo seeking entry into the United States, but if you sneak in, it's okay. When the inspector says you only have 90 days to stay here and you stay for 2 years, we don't care. So if we don't care, why are we telling them that if you're here on the visa waiver program, you only get to stay 90 days? If you're on a tourist visa, you only get to stay 6 months. And we need to get away from that automatic the way they're doing it and go back to what happened when I was an inspector. The most you could give somebody was 6 months, but we rarely did. For me to give someone 6 months, generally, it was an older person, or there were extenuating circumstances. 6 months is the maximum. So there is no consequence, and there is no law, because our laws depend on consequence. The laws of nature are immutable. The speed of light is not determined by somebody with a badge and a summons book and a radar gun. The speed of light is because the laws of nature are immutable. The laws of the human species are not. And laws that are unenforced aren't really laws. They become a bad joke. and they embolden people to commit more violations of law, more transgressions. Because what we're proving to people is we don't care. It's mind over matter, and for us it doesn't matter because we don't mind. Well, if it doesn't matter because we don't mind, then what does that tell people about how seriously we are still a country of law, not a country of men? We are now a country of Obama. Obama says, you can stay here. Obama says, you heard Simon says, now we're playing the game of Obama says. And how outrageous is that? So now that we've made immigration into a non-issue, mayors and governors and people who maybe don't really understand the significance of the immigration laws say, hey, you know what? This is cool. You know, I could hire a guy with employment authorization because it's no big deal if you're here illegally. It's no big deal if you run the border. It's no big deal if you're not an American citizen. Why? Obama says. You heard Simon says? Obama says. This is a very dangerous precedent, and we're opening the door to the potential for criminals and terrorists joining police departments. At the very least, what we are doing is providing unfair competition for Americans who desperately want to become police officers. You know, you go around the country, and you will find so many instances of women and minority members suing police departments so that they can get to become police officers or firefighters, civil servants. It's a decent job. It's got a pension, certain benefits, and it's a great way to serve your community. These are dangerous jobs. Being a police officer is very dangerous. You can get killed. You know, being a cop is not that much different from the military, except you sleep in your own bed at night, but dead is dead. Whether a police officer dies in some town in the United States or dies in Baghdad in combat, combat is combat, which is why police officers wear bulletproof vests and carry firearms. It's a dangerous job, but it's a good career. And so now what we're doing is allowing people who aren't citizens to compete with Americans who desperately want those jobs. Once again, who's paying the price? The average American who's looking to do better for himself or herself. On so many levels, this is the dopiest thing I've ever heard of. But today, dopey seems to be the new norm. Dopey is the new norm. Citizenship doesn't matter, or as Hillary might say, what difference does it make? And it's infuriating, and it's disconcerting. As cities and towns across America tighten up on firearms and how many bullets you can put in your gun, you know, in New York State, we have the SAFE Act. So unless you're retired law enforcement, you can only have a 10-round magazine with 7 bullets. They go through all this nonsense as though bad guys, terrorists, and crazy people are sitting there counting how many bullets they're putting into their illegally owned firearm. I mean, you can't make this up. Places around the country where aliens who snuck into the United States and because Obama says now have employment authorization may wind up getting a badge, a gun, and a uniform. And I assure you that those guns that the police carry are not limited to 7 bullets or 10-round magazines. And nobody is being made accountable for any of this. Nobody is being made accountable for any of this. And then, as I wrote for Californians for Population Stabilization, capsweb.org, they make big fanfare. Hey, you know, we just arrested over 2,000 criminal aliens under Operation Crosscheck. Well, you know, I was with Neil Cavuto on his program a couple of years ago, 2013, I think it was February, and the big headline was the sequestration of funding by Congress. And the administration, like a spoiled brat, said, oh, you don't have the money? We're going to release criminal aliens. And back then, I believe they released something like 68,000 aliens with criminal convictions. Turned them loose. When Congress tried to find out who they released, they wouldn't tell anybody. How many? Wouldn't tell anybody. Why? Because they're entitled to privacy. Now, this goes back to the Bush administration. See, it's both sides of the aisle that are shafting us. George Bush and Michael Chertoff got together, put their heads together, and said, you know, the privacy laws only protect American citizens and lawful immigrants, aliens with green cards who are on the path to citizenship. Why do we not cover all the other aliens who are in the country with privacy laws? So, by the stroke of George W.'s pen, even illegal aliens get the same privacy protection of U.S. citizens. Why? That's not what's in the law. But by executive action, because that was a case of George says. You know, We have Obama says. We have George says. I mean, this is the crazy stuff that's going on. By executive action, they decided to shield illegal aliens from the media. And the administration now turns around and says, well, we're not going to tell you who these people are or what crimes they've been convicted of, but we're turning them loose. And Neil was beside himself, and sometimes Neil can really whip himself up into a frenzy. And he said, does this make any sense? I said, well, look what they're going to do, Neil, because I predicted it. I said, you give the administration a few months, they'll launch some massive field operation, they'll pick up a couple thousand aliens, they will issue press releases and say to everybody, how great are we? How great are we? We just captured 2,000 criminal aliens, and you know, and everyone's going to give them a round of applause, and everybody will get happy, and they'll pop the champagne cork, and they'll celebrate. Meanwhile, they just let out 68,000. So how many of the 68,000 will they recapture? We won't know because no one has the names. No one knows if any of the ones released went out and raped some little child or went out and killed somebody or ran somebody over, because we don't know who they are. Why don't we know? Because they're protected by the privacy laws that aren't supposed to protect them. This is a betrayal of our country, of our citizens. It's undermining national security. It's undermining public safety. And where are the Republicans? Most of them are absolutely worthless. And I will tell you, there is a litmus test. Any politician, I'm going to repeat it again, any politician, I don't care what party, I don't care if you like them or not, who can come out and say, first secure the Mexican border, run for your life. Because that person is swindling you, and it's a big, fat, juicy lie. It's not first secure the border, it's first restore integrity to the system. That's what we should be hearing about. And if you restore integrity to the system, it becomes impossible to give millions of aliens who snuck into the country lawful status, because there can be no integrity to that process. But that's the first. First, make certain that the immigration system has integrity. If the immigration system had integrity, it would be impossible to give millions of aliens who snuck into the country lawful status. But that's the first. First, restore integrity. But wait a minute, integrity in politics does not go together very well. There is no such thing as integrity in politics. When politicians take money, and I don't mean that $100 contribution or that $200 contribution, I mean the thousands and thousands of dollars they are being bought and paid for. You know, we started out talking about local police. If you get pulled over by a police officer for speeding, let's say you're going 80 miles an hour, and you offer that police officer $50 or $100, there's an excellent chance that he will make like a jewelry salesman and show you a nice pair of bracelets and put them on you. And you will find that one size pretty much fits all. However, if you go to the mayor of that town where you were speeding and offer a significant campaign contribution, I'm willing to bet that just like the old Monty Hall on Let's Make a Deal, he'll raise the speed limit for you because he wants to be your friend, because he needs your money so he can run for re-election. If that isn't corrupt where one, I don't know what corruption is. You see, this notion of campaign contributions is a real problem. And then now the new buzzword, you're going to love this, is income equality. And everyone has jumped on the bandwagon. Yeah, I want some of that income equality. And because we as Americans, for the most part, flunk the wiggle test. I don't know if you folks know what the wiggle test is. I don't know if you've ever gone to the office, your doctor's office, and taken the wiggle test. But the wiggle test is this. You stick your left finger in your left ear, your right finger in your right ear, you wiggle your fingertips. If they touch, you flunk. Think how many Americans flunk the wiggle test. They're all excited about what? Income equality. I was watching Fox, and out came John Stossel. Oh, if people want income equality, they want a free meal. Yeah, okay. Either he's that foolish or he's part of the problem. Because the question that nobody is asking, and when I say it, you're gonna say, gee, what was I thinking? The critical question is who is going to be made more equal to whom? Everybody thinks, wow, I'm going to make money like Bill Gates. Do you think Bill Gates is going to tolerate that? They recently had this meeting of all these gazillionaires. You know, they fly in their airplanes that make Air Force One look like a cattle car. And they said, oh, we got to address income equality. And President Obama, Barack Obama, says, oh, we need to raise the minimum wage, right, to 10.10, you know, $10.10 an hour. That's how we get to income equality. And you know, watch the next time he stands in front of a bunch of clapping seals, the American people. Clap, 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 yay! Wait a minute. What did he just say? $10, and I wrote this article, by the way, I wrote about this for Progressives for Immigration Reform. And I said that for most Americans, the American dream is inaccessible, or it's no longer the American dream, however my friends over there had posted it. There is no American dream for Americans. How in the world does $10.10 an hour as a minimum wage help anybody achieve wage equality or reduce wage inequality? And if you do the math, that's what I keep saying in my article, do the math. It works out to like $21,000 a year. And you look at the fast food workers that want $15 an hour, and I'm an advocate for increased wages. I know that my conservative friends get upset with me, but the way I look at it is this. Nobody lives on $8 an hour anyway, because if you're making $8 an hour, you're getting food stamps, you're getting all kinds of subsidies. So one way or the other, I would rather workers get the bulk of their income from their work, not from an envelope that comes in through the mail slot, whether or not they go to their job. If you want to break the cycle of welfare and the cycle of dependency, then paychecks have to be significant enough that we show that labor does have value in our society. And everyone isn't going to be a rocket scientist. But believe me, the guy that's making $15 an hour is not living particularly well. I guarantee you that person doesn't have a car, doesn't dream of going to Europe on vacation or taking a cruise, because $15 an hour works out roughly to $31,000 or $32,000 a year. On $32,000 a year, who are you more equal to? Bill Gates, who makes $32,000 every 1/1,000th of a second? I don't think so. So if you look at what Alan Greenspan had to say when he testified for Chuck Schumer back on April 30th, 2009, and remarkably, Chuck now stands to become the most powerful Democrat in the Senate, God help all of us, to replace Harry Reid. We're going from bad to, what can I say? But the point of the matter is that it doesn't work out, because Greenspan talked about American skilled workers having too much money, earning this wage premium, calling them the privileged elite because we're not making them compete with foreign workers. Middle class workers earning a wage premium, they're the premium, they're the new elite. Really? These are elite, the economic elite. And he said that if we could open up our borders to unlimited, basically, H-1B visas, which is what Bill Gates wants, then he said we get rid of that wage premium, and this would greatly help to reduce wage inequality. So what is he really saying? That, you know, I guess if you raise the minimum wage a little bit and you really hammer the middle class into the ground, the gap between the middle class and the working poor will be eliminated, or at least greatly reduced. So this is a two-step. We're going to boost the wages so that the working poor make 20-odd thousand a year, and then we're going to hammer the hell out of the middle class so they get a lot closer to the poor. That's what wage equality means, folks. Understand what it really means. See through the subterfuge. When a politician, and I don't care if it's Obama or anybody else, can link raising minimum wage with wage equality, you know something is terribly wrong. Just do the math. Just do the math. Take out your pen and paper, take out your calculator, and figure it out. $30,000 a year is not wage equality when you're looking at Bill Gates and Zuckerberg or anybody else for that matter. This is the great deception that we're hearing from both sides of the aisle. And where's the mainstream media? Where is the mainstream media? Where's John Stossel? Oh, this is what people looking for a handout. Wage equality. John Oliver, the nitwit that's on HBO, spent half of his 30-minute program jumping up and down. Wage equality. People aren't making enough money. Wage equality. Wage equality isn't about raising salaries. It's about lowering them. Wage equality. Be careful what you wish for. You know, I hope that the perspectives that I'm providing to you, which are different from what you're hearing in the mainstream media, helps to open your eyes. If you find that what I'm talking about raises questions, causes you to look at things from a different angle, that's good, because that's what I'm trying to do. I want you to understand that we're being messed around with by the people that we elect to represent us. We are not being represented, folks. We are being deceived. We're being lied to. Our lives are being put at risk. If you want to know if the borders are secure, forget those lies. It has nothing to do with Border Patrol arrests. First of all, trying to figure out how many people are here based on arrests, as I told Neil Cavuto when I was on his program a while back, is like taking attendance by asking people not present to raise their hand. That's item number one. But item number two, those numbers get manipulated every day of the week, just the way they do with the unemployment numbers. These are the same people who have no problem telling you we have a 5.5% unemployment rate, knowing full well that almost 100 million Americans of working age are unemployed or underemployed. So believe me, everybody understands that this is absolutely a big con game, and we are being conned terribly. So understand what we're really talking about. If you really want to know if our borders are secure, and believe me, they're not. They're not even a speed bump. Think of this. Heroin and cocaine are contraband substances that are not produced in the United States. It is not legal to import heroin or cocaine. Every gram of those two substances represents graphic evidence of a failure of border security. We are arguably in the midst of the worst heroin epidemic in the history of the United States. And by the way, guess which border state suffered, if you want to call it that, the greatest amount of heroin seized by the DEA back last year? It was the border state of New York. We are indeed a country of 50 border states. So that's the metric. The fact that there are drugs out there, which is directly related to crime, therein lies the problem. I'm going to do something real quick, and I'm going to give you my websites again. And I thank you for joining me this Friday evening. I look forward to next week again. But this is the similarities between the two oldest professions, if you will, prostitution and politics. Both professions begin with the letter P. Both professions involve lots of people getting screwed. In both professions, the practitioners will assume any position, no matter how ridiculous, uncomfortable, or contrary to common sense, for the right price. In prostitution, the clientele bring their fantasies that the prostitute tries to fulfill. In politics, the constituent brings their concerns, and the politicians respond by making promises they fulfill by creating fantasies. STDs can give the clients of prostitutes a case of buyer's remorse, or perhaps a case of something far worse, while voters may well suffer buyer's remorse when they come to find out what their elected official does once he or she is sworn into office. Talk about the gift that keeps on giving. And that's really where we're at. So it's vital that you get the best information you can, and for that I ask that you go to michaelcutler.net, capsweb.org, Front Page Magazine, Progressives for Immigration Reform, The Daily Caller, The Social Contract. I write for all of those. Or go to other sources. But educate yourself, and please understand that it's not enough to become educated. You need to make the politicians accountable. You need to reach out to them and make it clear to them. Not only won't you vote for them, but you will work tirelessly to see to it that anybody, and I mean anybody, who will run against them, you will support and try to get elected if they don't represent you and your children. And while we speak about your children, please realize that you cannot be a good parent if you don't take care of becoming involved in politics, because this is about the survival of our children and their children. It's part of good parenting, and it's part of good citizenship. I want to remind all of you, as I always like to point out, democracy is most definitely not a spectator sport. It's incumbent on us to be involved, to be intelligent, to be educated, and to make the people who claim to represent us accountable. That's the obligation that we all have. And if we don't live up to that obligation, then ultimately our country and our children will pay the price. Simple stuff. Hope that you'll be with me next week again at the same time, right here on the Michael Cutler Hour. Have a great weekend, everybody.